You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Kia ora, my name's Mark. I'm a queer Bisaya artist, graphic designer, zine maker, and yeah, that is me.
Oh my gosh, thank you so much. And I did a little bit of research on you. So like, you currently have this event / exhibit in Studio One in Ponsonby. Could you please tell us more about it? Because you are the curator of this exhibit.
Yep. The idea came to me. I was watching this really gaudy 80s Filipino movie called The Black Dress, Blusang Itim. And it's an 80s one, so it's really quite crappy. Basically, the premise of this is this fugly lady, and unfortunately, it's quite patriarchal. So she's supposed to be fugly. And then she puts on this black dress that she saw at an op shop. And then suddenly she gets like rhinoplasty, and then her skin is white. Anyway, she becomes beautiful. And I thought that is quite camp. And I thought it was funny. And also, while I was watching that film, I was also doing research on Philippine folk Catholicism, because a lot of my art centers on, I love reading up about our pre-colonial stuff. And so so this particular exhibition is a tribute to the divinity of queerness as a transformative power able to imbue objects with divine spirit. Basically, what that means is when I was living in the Philippines, I had a friend who was this camp person. And what they did was they were actually commissioned by this church to create outfits for the Santo Niño or the Mother Mary. If you're not Catholic, these are like little icons of religious faith. So Santo Niño is a baby Jesus. So yeah, she was asked to do the baby Jesus and the Mother Mary. So while watching this 80s movie and while reminiscing about my life, as well as reading up about Philippine folk Catholicism, I was like, oh, queer people actually in the Philippines are tasked with creating divine glamour, meaning they're tasked to do all these like religious regalia for the saints, for the Mother Mary or whatever. And it is like, even though Catholicism is actually at odds with homosexuality, there is this tiny niche that is reserved for queer folk within that religion. That's why we call it folk Catholicism and not simply Catholicism, because if you look at how we practice it in the Philippines, it's quite different to like Spain, which was the ones who infected us with this religion. So it's very different. That's why it's called folk, because the reason being, a lot of our pre-colonial beliefs, for them to convert us, they had to sort of insert it. So one of that is basically queer folk had like a niche in Catholicism in the Philippines. So yeah, so these clothes that my friend makes, that they get commissioned by this church, is treated as religious artifacts themselves, akin to the artifact of the baby Jesus, to the Mother Mary. So these clothes are like, they're also revered. And so basically, all those ideas that were circulating in my head became Ang Sininang Bulawan, the golden dress. Also, I knew all these artists. So one is Dennis Sayat, who created the gown. So I knew that, oh, I know someone who can make a gown, right? And then I knew Maria Del Gamit, who does animated work, and they know how to do projections. So I'm like, okay, cool. I know someone who can, in a physical manifestation, imbue the dress that will be made with spirit, because that's how my brain works. And then I was like, oh, cool. I heard this really cool track by this artist named Magenta. And so Magenta's work, if you've heard the track at Studio One exhibition, is basically they've recorded these frogs from their area of the Philippines. And so you can hear these frogs are like croaking. And then Magenta overlays it with an EDM beat. So it's like cantified. Oh, sorry. I shouldn't be swearing. They're like...
It's okay. You can swear on this podcast.
Yeah. So they're like, let's yesified frogs. So they're just like croaking, but then the underlay of the EDM. So actually, it's quite immersive. So you're looking at this gown being bathed in the projection by Maria Del Gamit, and then overlaid by a soundtrack of like frogs, which I think grounds the piece into, oh, this is not just ethereal, it's also of this world, because it's physical as well as spiritual. So yeah, the frogs with the EDM beat. And so that creates the whole piece. That's me.
Honestly, the moment you start speaking about the dresses in the Catholic Church, I was like, I would remember a moment where when I was younger, I would have to like, I was asked by my mom, hey, can you like go touch the dress in the church? Because in the actual church itself, if you want to be blessed by God, you can touch these like artifacts or the dresses that's in display, right? And when the moment that you mentioned that, I was like, oh my gosh, my childhood is being brought back. You know what?
Yeah, the handkerchief that you used to touch the thing also gets imbued. So it's like a little, it's like conductive.
And I also wanted to ask, when you were talking about spirituality, was there, because I looked into the narrative from the exhibition, can you tell us more about like the Balbayan narrative as well? Because I feel like there's a lot of people that'll be interested to know about that part of Philippine history as well.
Oh, yes. So in pre-colonial Philippine history, our communities were set up as like there was the datu, which was, I'll just say that, like the king. And the counterpart of the datu is like the priest. So the priest is like the babay, they're called babaylan. So it's like a yin and yang, because the datu has like powers that are destructive, like their one touch can kill people or whatever. And the counterpart to that is the babaylan, which is like their healers, their seers. So they were the center of community life. And basically there's others, but the babaylan are a matriarch. So it's mostly elder women, and it's mostly like you're chosen. You can't just be like, I'm going to apply to be babaylan. It doesn't work that way in those days. The spirits choose you or something. Anyway, because it's a matriarch, only women can actually do this. But then in the text, queer folk who display feminine traits are also, they can go in, meaning we are allowed into the patriarchy, these queer folk. And so I just want to clarify that the babaylan is not queer folk itself, or just because you're queer doesn't mean you're immediately that. It just means queer folk can also have the power of the babaylan. That's how I want to make sure people are not like, oh my god, I'm babaylan, which is very common in social media. I've been seeing it, which is incorrect. So yeah, so the babaylan are like a matriarch that allow queer folk into the ranks, and they balance out the destructive power of the king, the datu. So yeah, there's a whole initiation, right, that goes with being babaylan. So you have to be strong of spirit, strong of will, all that, because you get really sick and all that. So yeah, only chosen people can become it. And so in the context of the pre-colonial communities, those two were the main driving forces of community.
And then that kind of leads back into your artwork right now, isn't it? Because we want to know that your journey as an artist, because in Malau, we always ask that question, is like, where were you before this exhibition? Like, where did you lead yourself up to this?
Wow. So when I first came to New Zealand, I was introduced into the world of zine making. So I was quite active in the Auckland zine communities. And so I made this zine called I Am Brown, I Will Not Frown. And it talks about my identity of being Filipino in a white space, New Zealand, and all the baggage that comes with that. And so this zine, the first chapter talks about the history, a very brief history of queerness. And the second chapter relates, how does that relate to me now as a queer person? And so anyway, I was in the zine community. And then in 2019, curators from the Smithsonian from America were looking for, their term there was culture bearers, a bit wanky, but you know, people who were very into their culture or whatever. And they reached out to me and were like, hey, we're doing this group exhibition. It was for the Smithsonian and Auckland Museum in 2019. Would I like to be part of it? And I was like, would I like to be part of it? Excuse me. And so from then, I created an artwork, which is more of a very well-researched account on the history of the babaylan, or the queer folk in babaylan. So anyway, it was like, that was my very first, like, I thought, oh my god, I'm an artist. I was with all these other artists who are quite established, and I had massive imposter syndrome. So that was 2019. And from that show, I was asked by Object Space to do another piece of work. So basically, from that show, I was more empowered to feel like, oh, I'm an artist, not just a zine maker. And so the Object Space one was more about what I call queer indigenous futurism, which is like, the question it was answering was, what if queer folk in contemporary society, we all had access to our babaylan heritage, meaning the babaylan had all these powers and had spirit guides and all that. What if we had all those intact in contemporary society, and what does that look like? And so it was like a retelling of, oh, what if I was a baby, like, or what if I was younger, a queer folk who was babaylan or whatever. And then it just goes through this journey of that. And for Object Space, I also asked Dennis Syed, who is the dressmaker, to create these gowns inspired by my spirit guide in the Object Space exhibition. And then we asked people from the ballroom community, Diesel and Magic from the House of Coven Karanji, to embody the artists. So we were two artists. We created narratives of us becoming babaylan. And then Dennis created the gowns for the two people from ballroom community to wear. And then I think from that, this thing came up, and I was like, oh, why don't I just do this Lusang Itim, the folk Catholicism, blah, blah. And so I'd like to think a lot of my work builds upon my previous work. So yeah, So you see me now.
No, I get it as well. It kind of like leads it on basically like stacks on stacks on previous work, right? Basically, it's like practice, right? It's like a little mm-hmm. practice before a next big thing. And mm-hmm. that kind of like leads up to my next question, because with the work that you do, obviously not Filipino families kind of like accept that because they have like that old traditional conservative, like you have to do what we used to do in the past. Because I'm currently going through that right now with my family, because one of them told me to hurry up and get a job that's in the corporate world or in the nursing world. And I'm like, let's be for real. Like, we all knew that's not going to happen. So I wanted to ask this on behalf of like the Filipino community, like, what is your thoughts on your passion over like what your family wants from you?
I think there is an intersectionality that's happening here, right? Like, I grew up sort of like maybe middle class in the Philippines. So there is a lot of struggle that a lot of overseas foreign workers who work in Aotearoa have to do. There's a lot of expectation for them because, again, they came here to survive, to send money overseas. Like, there's a lot of burdens that a lot of Filipinos who live here have to go through. And so I think I'm in a very privileged position where I never have to do those types of responsibilities. My parents, their only concern was, are you happy? And I know this from my other friends and from, oh my God, TikTok, this sounds so weird. Like, you know those jokes about, oh, I'm the eldest child of this Filipino family and I have to make sure to earn money to send overseas. I had none of that. And the whole, your family controlling you as well, like, oh, you've gotten fat. When are you getting married? Whatever, anything that has to do with controlling of you as a person, because you're our only hope, you're overseas. I never had to do any of that because I didn't have to do that. So I'm very thankful to my parents. Thanks, mom and dad. That the only thing I had to overcome was just, you know, becoming an artist, I guess. So, yeah.
That inspires me as a creative myself, that you have the strength to do that as well without having any worries or doubts about worrying for someone else. Was there anything that you wanted to ask, Otto?
I don't know. I was just thinking, so based off of the answer you gave, I know like financial constraints play a large role in family structures in the Philippines, but would you say that, you know, Philippine society at large is generally supportive of people who want to go into the arts, or is it a little bit more complex than that?
I think the reason why maybe not a lot of Filipino families who come here, not a lot of their children who may want to be in the arts, maybe they're being dissuaded because they're like, we came here all the way. We had to sell our cows. We had to sell some land to come here. And so for them to do all of that, and then for their child to do something that they think is maybe will not make this child survive. You know, they're only thinking about, I want to make sure my child has a steady paycheck. I don't know, the Kiwi dream of buying a house, you know? So there's all those things that are put on you immediately when your family relocates to New Zealand for a better life. And so art and anything that does not look lucrative from that perspective is maybe frowned upon. I know some people who still do their corporate job and do art on the side because they have to still play the role of like, oh, I'm still the good child of my parents. And also the support from my parents are also very important. Like, if I grew up in a family where they were like, Mark, when are you going to stop doing this art thing so you can become, I don't know, like a nurse or something more lucrative? Because so I quit my job in advertising, which was, again, a lucrative job. If I had a different family, they might be like, don't do that. Art is unstable, blah, blah, blah. So kudos to those Filipino kids who are out here doing art. That's all I can say.
We have one more question to wrap it up, mm-hmm. because we always ask this to our creative guests that come to our show, is representation. Does representation matter for those who cannot speak up for themselves? Because, for example, we don't see many Filipinos, Malaysian, Thai creatives or artists in the mainstream media here in Aotearoa. What do you think about that?
Well, I guess, again, because art is seen as a luxury or seen as not a real high-paying job, I guess you won't see a lot of countries who came here to like, I'm gonna survive, you know, and if that's your focus, then good on you. But having said that, the landscape is changing. Like, and I say this because I'm working on this archive, an online archive called satellites.co.nz. Not me plugging my work. So I'm an archivist. I'm part of the archivist team. So we archive all the art, well, as much as our funding can allow. of Asian artists and art makers in Aotearoa. You can, this satellites that coded NZ, you can search by ethnicity or by art practice, by region, whatever you want. Each of us have our own expertise. Some are zines, some are theater, some are whatever. So if you go on satellites.co.nz and you type in the search bar Filipino, you will get to meet more of these Filipino artists who are maybe invisible because they don't get as much, you know, you don't hear about them as much. And maybe they're more reticent to be like, hey, I'm an artist, you know, because we're all like, oh my God, I'm an artist. At the very beginning, when if you talk about the current landscape, for example, definitely I would say representation matters so much because you can't be what you don't see. So currently, as we know, it's very white. So currently we just have to do this. Like it is like level one is, oh, we have to represent da da da. But also I dream of a future where the work of minoritized artists such as us are not reduced to identity and representation, but instead an actual celebration of your talent and skill and storytelling. But you know, we're at level one, or maybe we're at level two, we don't know, where you have to get ourselves out there. So people go, oh my gosh, Filipinos are not just nurses. They're actually quite, they have a very unique sense of storytelling. We have something to share, to contribute to Aotearoa in general. And then once that level one is done, then maybe we can just, we can relax and be like, okay, I can just do shit art of my cat, you know, without having to be, this is not Filipino art. You have to represent our entire nation. You know, there is that onus that is placed upon us because we're so few, we're so new on the scene. But yeah, level one, we're getting there. And if you look at satellites, not me plugging this again, you will see a lot of art makers who are doing that. And hopefully the new generation of Filipino artists will just be like, yeah, I'm going to do memes and that'll be my art practice. And I love that for these future kids who don't have to do, oh, I'm a Filipino, I was poor, you know, that's my but it's just
that's
not
crazy.
Not that's wrong. It's part of it.
Thank you so much. And we hope to see you guys soon because your exhibition ends on the 21st, right?
My exhibition ends on the 20th of February. But immediately after that, on the 21st, I'm producing something for Pride called Queer Asian Arts Market. That's in Ellen Melville. Please follow us on Instagram, Queer AAM. Not me plugging for this.
No, that's all good.
We need people to like this damn Instagram business.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Thank you.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.